Welcome to the Wall Street News Network podcast. I am pleased to be talking to Sachin Kajuria, the founder of Achilles Management and former partner at Apollo, one of the world's largest alternative asset management firms. He has 25 years of investment and finance experience and holds degrees in economics from the University of Cambridge. He is also the author of the recently released book 2N20. Welcome, Sachin.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here, Fred.
All right. So I believe that most of the listeners are probably aware of what a private equity firm is, but there are some people that aren't aware, or they confuse it with a hedge fund or something like that, which is obviously dramatically different. So why don't you just take a minute and kind of describe what an equity fund does?
Private equity is essentially investing in, or in some cases lending to, an operating business. So a business that's in existence, or a business plan that is about to be funded. And after investing in this business through equity, most oftentimes, but also sometimes through debt, that business is helped by the private equity professionals who will often sit on the board or have a position of significant influence, by working with the management team of that business to improve it, usually to grow it, and ultimately after a period of several years, could be 5 years, could also be up to 10 years, exit that business. So the money, the profit, hopefully, will go back to the investors who put up the money in the first place, minus the fees that are charged by the private equity firm.
Okay. So the big difference from a hedge fund is, the hedge funds go into publicly traded companies and that type of thing primarily. And whereas the companies you go into, they're privately held. Am I kind of saying that correctly?
Yeah, there's a few differences, and that's certainly one of them. I'd say first, hedge fund investments are often not as long-term. They can be, but often they're investments for a year or two or three. Private equity investments in general can tend to be much longer-term investments. And the reason for that is that you are not just looking at the financial side of the business, as you would in lots of different kinds of financial investment scenarios, but you're really working very hard on the operating side too, in tandem with management. So if you're not buying control, which is often the case, you're in a position of significant influence in that business. So you really are a reasonably long-term investor in that business. And as you say, second, usually the businesses are private or they're taken private. So you can buy a public company and take it private by taking an office stock exchange. And so these are two of the big differences. I'd say a third difference is that the investment professionals involved in private equity deals are a little bit different to the professionals involved in hedge fund deals, most oftentimes, because the job is a little bit different. And the job is different because you're not only looking at the capital structure, cash flows, and all the financial side, but you're really equally involved in the operating side as the key kind of help at the board level and in between board meetings of the senior management team. So there's a few differences there that cover the public nature versus the private nature, the kind of work that's being done, and I think also the typical duration of the investment.
Okay, great. Now I want to ask you about what's on most people's mind these days, and that relates to a possibility of a recession. Now, the first quarter of 2022, the real GDP was down 1.5% from the previous quarter. And, you know, when I was in college, I learned that, one downturn in a quarter is a correction, 2 to 3 downturns is a recession, and 4 is a depression. And we're close to the end of this second quarter. Do you think we're heading into two downturns in a row? And what do you think is the probability of a recession?
So I think let's take a little bit of a step back and look at the position we were in prior to 22. Owing to a series of massive financial measures by the Fed and other central banks around the world, plus measures by governments to support jobs and to support industries by basically sponsoring people even if their businesses were shut down, right? The economy, the global economy, kind of bounced back reasonably well from what was a kind of forced shutdown with COVID and the pandemic, where it just had to shut everything. People just went home, had to almost shut down the economy to try and slow all the interaction down. I think what's happened this year is that inflationary pressures that were building up, possibly due to a lot of money in the system, but also lots of other factors. Plus, the war in Ukraine and a number of supply side issues have really led to quite a serious inflationary impact we've been talking about. And so, again, our authorities are called upon to act to try and control these situations. And of course, they're raising interest rates. They're also trying to roll off the amount of money printing that's been done because you can't just keep printing money at hundreds of billions of dollars forever. And the combined impact of all of these effects, including some shocks to the economy, has resulted in a change in sentiment, possibly a change in confidence, and results of some firms coming out as we look at quarterly results of public companies starting to turn for the worse. So that's different than saying we're on the edge of a recession tomorrow. I'd probably put the chances personally at something like 1 in 3. But it's getting a little bit worse week by week. But it's one of those situations where we just have to watch and hope that the balancing act that's being conducted right now between interest rates, inflation, the knock-on effects on confidence, plus the other shocks we're having, don't result in us tipping into a recessionary period. In other words, 2+ quarters of negative growth. I think it's also important to look at, Fred, even if we're not in a recession, what are we in? And I think we're going to be in an environment this year that isn't that pleasant. So even if we're not in a recession or we're in a low growth, higher inflation environment, that's still not a nice place to be, is it? And so the way we look at it as, there's tough waters ahead. Asset prices are not just going to keep going up. We look at the volatility in 22. And that leads us to the topic of today and obviously the book, which is the what's on the investment menu for everyone is changing. Not just because of the environment we're in, but also because access to private funds is changing. And so that's leading a lot of people to pivot from looking at just public markets to also looking at private markets for a portion of their portfolio. And I stress a portion because it's illiquid and you're kind of tied up. And, we're all looking at the same sort of questions here, which is, does it make sense to put some of our capital into private markets, or in my case, more of it into private markets, given how volatile the public markets are in this current macro climate. So 1 in 3 at the moment, I'd say it's probably a reasonable guess. With the signs getting a little bit worse, and what I'm in particular a little concerned about is dents to consumer and business confidence for people who are going to start putting off those expenditures, or businesses may start to postpone those investments. Right now, I think the U.S. economy seems to be still in pretty decent shape. That's what the Fed is saying. That's what a lot of the data does show. But it's changing, and it's something we will have to be very cognizant about, not just for our own, employment and jobs, but also when we look at our portfolios that may be building for us for retirement and whether we should be pivoting a bit into private markets.
Okay. Now, you've mentioned inflation a couple times. How high do you think inflation will go?
I don't have a crystal ball, I'm afraid, but I think that the question is more whether it's peaked. And if it hasn't peaked, it may still go up a little bit. But I think the problem is, even if it doesn't go any higher, it really can't stay at this level for too much longer, just because there's real pain being inflicted on everybody, particularly those who feel it the most, mm-hmm. who you know, find it really tough when they go to the gas station or go to the markets to buy their groceries and so on. I mean, it's very tough. And so, although I hope there isn't too much room to go on the upside, the problem is, even if it stays where it is or even come down a tiny bit, it needs to come down a lot for us to really feel good about things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's commonly referred to as stagflation when we have higher inflation and the economy is kind of stagnating. Would you agree that we're kind of approaching that right now?
There's a real risk in that. You know, I think that that is one of the number one things, one of the top things that we should be concerned about. And that's why I said before, you know, rather than necessarily looking for the soundbite or the technical answer of, are we in a recession right now, or is inflation peaking right now? Let's just take a step back and say, all right, let's say it's peaked and it's coming down, but not enough. Or let's say we miss a recession, even though it looks difficult to miss a recession of some kind. And even if it's a shallow recession, maybe it's not a deep recession like we've had in the past, right?
Mm-hmm.
But even if it isn't a deep recession, what is it? That's the key point.
Yeah.
And if not being in a recession, Fred, means, well, low growth and inflation above what's tolerable, that's not a good place to be.
Yes.
And we need to hope that through coordinated action, we can get out of that. Because it's been a really tough period. I mean, if you look at it, you know, in Europe, there was Brexit, a number of issues. In the U.S., we've talked about how politics is just polarizing all the time. You know, then we had COVID out of nowhere. It kind of took 2 years off everybody's life. Just really devastating impact. And now we have a war in Ukraine, in Europe, I guess, mm-hmm. which no one really, you know, would have thought was possible again. And so we've been hit by all these shocks. And to give the policymakers a bit of credit, you know, they've had a pretty full plate,
yes.
dealing with, you know, pulling us out of the worst impacts of COVID, trying to contain things. You know, I almost kind of worry what's next. But, and so without getting too dramatic about it, I do think it's reasonably natural to look at our portfolios and say, okay, we may have felt pretty good in 2021, probably feeling not too good with our public portfolios in 2022 in general.
Mm-hmm.
What do we learn from this? You know,
yeah.
I think one of the things we learn is looking at private markets that do not have this kind of volatility of, you know, 30% up, 30% down,
mm-hmm.
and seeing whether there's a portion of capital we can lock up. And I emphasize lock up because it's liquid usually.
Yes.
And make sense for us to build for retirement through not just how much in stocks, how much in bonds, you know, 60-40 or whatever. It's mm-hmm. also like, well, hang on a minute, should I be putting 10, 20, 30% of my capital in private markets?
Mm-hmm.
And that takes you to the question of, okay, an active business, people business, where do I put it? And, you know, it's not like buying an ETF. It's not like buying a mutual fund. It's not passive investing. It's not something that is, you know, relatively plain vanilla.
Mm-hmm.
It's very active investing. It's a premium service. It's charged at a much higher rate because it's a premium service, because it's an active managed service with people involved in making decisions. And so I think all these things come together to have us look at, you know, should we be putting some more capital into private markets? And if so, what are the decision criteria we should be using? Because it's about people's judgment. And I think those criteria include not just the financial metrics, which are key, making sure we understand what the real net returns are net of all these fees, but also what are the characteristics of success that, you know, people think are durable, replicable in the key firms. And that's really what the book is about, which is trying to, you know, summarize what I've seen in the last 25 years of some of the common characteristics of success I've seen, not just in firms or funds that are winning, you know, year to year or cycle to cycle, that are continuously winning. And I think kind of breaking away from the pack of the leaders in this industry.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm going to get back to your book in a second, but I do want to ask, because this is a question that everybody wants to know, is what do you think is the timeline for the stock market to bottom out, or do you have any idea? I mean, do you think we're in a bear market, or are we, in a temporary correction? Any thoughts on that?
I mean, again, I try not to call the markets week to week. I mean, I think if you look at, year to date, the S&P has kind of fluctuated between the last few days, negative 18%, negative 20%. It's a bear market. Oh, it's not a bear market today. It is a bear market tomorrow. I think the truth is it's just a very difficult, choppy market.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not happy. And it's not happy. It's not positive. The reason for that is everything we've been discussing until now, that the macro picture has got dramatically worse, and we are concerned that it may involve a slowdown, and if not a slowdown or a recession, then at least much tougher economic times than we had thought, coming out of COVID.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if I had to guess, and it's purely a guess,
uh-huh.
we'll continue to have jagged, negative, volatile, positive, volatile moves in the major industries, in the major indices for most of this year.
Mm-hmm.
And, it doesn't take much for the markets to suddenly turn one way or the other. A certain initiative in the war in Europe, in Ukraine, suddenly starts looking like, one side is going to win or lose, tends to sort of worry about escalation. Uh-huh. And then that kind of gets taken over by whether inflation has peaked or it hasn't peaked. Has it peaked? I don't know if it's peaked. So all these kind of week-to-week, day-to-day movements are very hard to call.
Mm-hmm.
I think what's probably more helpful to folks is say, look, we're in a very tough environment now. It could get a lot worse, but at the moment, it's certainly less stable and less robust in terms of how much we can rely on these valuations staying roughly where they are or improving. It's just a lot less robust.
Yeah.
I think that's going to last for the balance of the year.
Uh huh. I'd like to ask, how did you get into private equity?
So I followed a very standard route, which was to work in investment banking for a few years and then to move into an investment role. And then people either stay at exactly the same firm or they can move between investment firms every number of years, 5 years or longer or whatever. And so I started in investment banking after college, and then I moved into an investment role 5 years after that.
I see. Do you have any advice for a young person who wants to get into the private equity field? Maybe they're in a university now and they like the idea of private equity. Any suggestions?
Sure. I mean, I'll tell you and them hopefully the same as I tell the people that I mentor. And I mentor quite a few younger folks who are either in the industry or going into the industry. Number one, understand this is a people business.
Mm-hmm.
And as a people business, it is about judgment, it's about relationships, it's about empathy. And number two, you are looking at a business where you are not an advisor. You are a principal. You are part of the decision-making set. And this is all covered in the book, of course, but mm-hmm. as a principal, you need to be attracted to the idea that you eat what you cook.
Mm-hmm.
You're aligned with your investors. If they make money, you make money. If they don't do well, you shouldn't do that well either, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that is a dynamic which really suits some people and does not suit other people. Some people are incredible financial minds, great people, but they are naturally or they're best off or they're more interested in being advisors, whether that means investment bankers or it means consultants or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to think about that. I think the other thing I'd say is that I try to think of this as a life skill to invest, not just a job. As soon as you think of this as, I need to know how to invest, whether, let's say you're in college and you're wondering whether you want to do this path or that path. You should try to learn how to invest, even if you become something totally different. You go into medicine, you become a doctor, or you become an entrepreneur, you're living in tech, you're starting out your business, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You need to know what you're going to do with it as you start to accumulate some wealth, once you've paid all your student debts, and once you've moved forward in your financial picture. What are you going to do with it? Are you just going to leave it to everybody else to manage? Are you going to be a passive participant in your financial future? You shouldn't be. So once you start looking at it as a little bit of a skill, it'll kind of filter out whether you're really interested in it, because you think you need to learn it, you want to learn it, not just whether you want to work in that field. Does that make sense?
Yes.
And so, you know, I think that if you are interested in this, you know, you will probably think to yourself, well, let's say I work really hard as a college professor, or I work really hard as, you know, this profession or that profession, and I build up some savings. I want to know what to do with it. I don't just want to hand it over to somebody and not have a clue. And say, well, no, money matters, or for them, I don't know anything about money. That's not right.
Mm-hmm.
You should have some idea. Doesn't mean you have to be an expert. Doesn't mean you have to second guess everything that smart people tell you who might be working with you at a bank or asset manager or wherever. But you should be able to ask some questions. You should be able to understand it. You should be able to read the Wall Street Journal and know what it means. And so once you look at it as a skill you need to learn, that makes the whole thing a lot easier to determine whether it's for you. Mm-hmm. And then it's about, you know, way ahead of time, reading the right journals, reading the right books, talking to as many people as you can, and just really getting yourself as educated as possible about this, because it is a people business. It's not something automated, and you need to just try and understand the mindset. I think the winning mindset, which is quite common amongst the best firms that I've seen, and see whether that mindset aligns with, you know, what interests you and what motivates you, and whether you think that, you know, you can be one of those people and it's natural to you.
Yeah, that's great advice. Now, I just want to talk about your book real briefly. It came out recently. It's called 2 and 20. First, can you tell the listeners what 2 and 20 means, and then talk just a little bit about what's covered in your book?
Sure. So 2 and 20, subtitle is How the Masters of Private Equity Always Win. So 2 and 20 is the fee structure that you find in the private equity industry. You also find it in a similar way to the hedge fund industry. And it refers to a management fee, which is often 2% of the money that's being managed annually, plus an incentive fee. In other words, taking a share of the profits if, hopefully, the investments you're making a profit. And that's 20%. Now, at first part, you might say, well, hang on a second. I can invest in an index fund at 5 basis points, 10 basis points, or 0.5%. Maybe it's more actively managed like some mutual funds.
Mm-hmm.
Why would I pay 2% management fees and I'd have to give a share of the profits? Well, it goes back to, it's a very premium service. It's highly active management. It's not passive. It's not replicating an index. It's not even picking individual stocks. It's working with companies at the operating level, working with management teams for years to then exit at a discount. I'm sorry, exit at a profit, hopefully, and then, you know, charge some fees, take a share of the profits. And you can't discount the expertise there. You have to respect and value the hard work and the smarts that are being done there. And the subtitle, How the Masters of Private Equity Always Win. When I say the Masters of Private Equity, I'm referring to the ones who I've worked with and I invest with now, who I think are among the best. So how do what I think are the best firms, you know, whether they're public firms themselves these days or they're private firms in some cases still, how do they do it? Mm-hmm. Because it can't just be the fee formula. Lots of firms have similar formulas, whether it's 2 and 20 or it's 1% and 15% of the profits or whatever the formula happens to be. More or less, lots of firms have similar formulas. And they all went to great business schools and they're all smart people. So it can't just be that they all have the same incentive. It has to be something else. What I think it is the best folks have a winning mindset. And I try to tap into that psychology of winning by peeling layer by layer, or painting brushstroke by brushstroke, each of those characteristics of success that I think make some of the best firms and why they keep winning cycle after cycle, year after year, and why I think they're amongst the best in the industry. Mm-hmm. And so the book is organized into a series of chapters that go through each of these lessons and tenets. So you take each of the principles, like we talked about, the one where you're a principal, not an advisor, And then we use deal stories where we've, you know, had to mask certain details that need to remain private. But we use deal stories to tell a story of how that principle works in action behind the curtain in a way that you can't see if you're outside the industry. What happens in that boardroom? What happens in that meeting? What's really happening? How does it really work day to day? How are they really thinking when things go wrong as well as when things go well? How do they fix it? Most of the times they do fix it if something goes wrong. And therefore, you're getting a kind of, you know, in the boardroom view that's hidden to most. Mm-hmm. That's explaining and illustrating these principles, the psychology of winning. And I think it will be quite eye-opening for people who are interested in private equity and also more generally private markets, because it applies to not just private equity, but also to private credit, infrastructure, and the other areas of private markets that most of the major firms also, also specialize in as part of their basket of investment strategies.
I see. That's great, great information. And I'm actually about halfway through the book, and I find it fascinating, easy to read, easy to understand, and I highly recommend it. I wanted to thank you for your time, and I just want to remind the listeners, remember the book is called 2 and 20. It's available through all major book dealers, including Amazon. And I want to thank you again, Sachin. It was a great interview and great information.
Thank you so much. I hope it's helpful, and all the best to your listeners.